Traveling with gear, loading a bipod, and wind this week on Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and this is Mail Call Mondays, the show that answers your questions about precision rifles, optics, and equipment. Welcome to another Mail Call Mondays, and our first question this Monday is from Jeff, one of our Patreon subscribers. And Jeff asks, question for a future MCM. If flying to a precision rifle class or match, how do you handle the metric ton of stuff you need to bring? The rifle seems easy, but between all the ammo, spotter, tripod, bags, tools, backpack, etc., plus usual travel needs like your clothes, it seems like you'd need to check a lot of bags and rent an F-150. What has your experience been, and what suggestions do you have? Well, Jeff, you're right. The struggle is real. We do have to drag a whole lot of stuff along if we are going to fly or drive to a precision rifle match or training. What I recommend is, or my personal preference is, if at all possible, I drive. This factored into my last vehicle purchase. I was looking for vehicles, and instead of buying a Jeep or a full-size truck, I bought a Subaru Crosstrek, which gives me ground clearance like a Ford Explorer would. It has all-wheel drive, but it gets really good gas mileage and has a lot of features on it that are very useful for long road trips. So I drive if at all possible because it requires me to be a little bit less restrictive on what gear I bring. I can throw my cooler in the back, drinks, you know, all kinds of stuff, and I can bring the what-if gear. So I can bring more tools, more equipment to be able to assist myself or other shooters if there's a problem. Now, sometimes that's just not possible. Sometimes we have to fly across country. Our time allotment is pretty compressed, so I can't take the extra 2 days that it would take to drive from here to Vegas or California or Oregon or any of those places. And then I'm kind of required to fly. When I have to fly, I usually try to keep my baggage down to my Pelican case, a sea bag, a duffel bag, and a backpack. Now, the duffel bag and backpack are carry-on bags. I check the rifle case and the C bag. And I'm usually able to get everything that I need for a multi-day match or a several-day class into those bags. Now, the trick with the Pelican case is try to limit what you're putting in the Pelican case. Obviously, any firearms need to go in that case. So if I'm taking a long gun, it goes in there. If I'm taking a handgun that I have to check, that is going to go in that case as well. I'll usually also throw magazines in there because magazines are fairly light when they're not loaded. If it's a firearm I'm going to need access to quickly on the other side, then I will put my loaded magazines in the Pelican case as well. And if you guys want to know more information on how to check or how to fly with checked firearms, we have an article up on our website. It's a little bit old now, but it is still pretty much relevant as far as what you have to do and have to be aware of when you fly with your firearms. Now, there are some added restrictions that individual airlines have put in place after some previous incidents. So whatever the airline decides, they have some of their own procedures. But the information on our website is pretty much based on federal law and FAA regulations and TSA regulations at the point in time that it was written. We may do a revision on it a little bit later on. So anyway, the Pelican case just contains my long gun, my handgun, whatever weapons I'm taking that need to be secured with locks. I don't put my ammunition in the Pelican case because if we're flying to a two-day match, that's going to be a couple of boxes of ammunition. It's going to add significantly to the weight of that case. And the Pelican case and the weapons inside of it are already heavy enough. So I don't want to make that case too heavy. It can cause damage to it. It can cause baggage handlers to handle it in a rougher manner. So I don't put that in there. My ammunition, I will usually put in plastic ammo boxes, and then I will additionally tape it closed as well. I don't just rely on the latches on the box. And that is usually more than sufficient. It complies with the regulations as far as how it needs to be carried. And I've gotten to the other end and have my ammo boxes cracked, but I haven't had any of them damaged to the point where the cartridges inside were damaged or that the cartridges inside came loose. If I'm going to carry a tripod or any of that stuff, then that will go in the sea bag. And any other field gear, my match clothes, that kind of stuff will all get packed in the sea bag in addition to a ghillie suit or any other field gear that I need. Between the rifle case and the sea bag, that is generally where all of my shooting gear and my field gear will go. My carry-on duffel bag and my backpack, that is where my regular travel clothes, my going out clothes, all that stuff, and any sensitive electronics will go in those bags. So my Kestrel, anything that is small and compact and high value that is carry-on approved will go in those bags. That way I don't have to worry about my Kestrel getting lost en route or getting damaged inside the bag. And I like to have my toiletries and my regular clothes with me on the plane because you never know when you're going to get diverted, get rerouted. If for some reason you get stuck in an airport and your flight gets canceled, you're generally not going to have access to your checked baggage unless you go through a lot of extra steps. So it's nice to be able to have everything that you need for an overnight on you in your carry-on baggage. Plus, the airlines allow you generally to carry one carry-on and then one personal item. So I use a duffel bag as my carry-on and then I use a backpack as my personal item. I also have to generally carry camera equipment with me because of the show and because of the stuff that I'm doing. So my camera equipment will always go in my carry-on bags. I don't trust camera equipment to check baggage unless I'm also putting it in a purpose-built Pelican case that I can lock closed. So that's just how I pack and how I divide my gear up. Now, a tip on reducing the amount of stuff that you are actually taking to matches or to training is to do your research. If you're going to training, then the instructor or the company putting on the training should have provided a gear list that will let you know what they expect you to bring and what you need to get the most out of their training. Matches can be a little bit trickier. Generally, you'll need to look at previous reports from the matches, talk to previous shooters, find out what stages are common for these kind of matches, and find out what equipment that you need to bring to be successful at those matches. Very often when we've driven to matches, I'll throw a tripod, a shooting tripod, in the back of the car just because, and then I'll get there, I'll shoot the entire match, and never had a chance to use the shooting tripod. So when you're driving, that's not that big of a deal. When you're flying, that's a lot of extra weight and a lot of extra bulk to drag around if you didn't actually need it. So do a little bit of research and find out what it is that you think that you will need to be successful in that match. And sometimes not having something like a shooting tripod can just force you to be a little bit more creative in how you address a stage or allow you to get a little bit more acquainted with other shooters because you may have to borrow a piece of gear from them. But do your research and try not to overpack. Try to resist that what if gear thing when you're flying. And a final tip for you, you mentioned the rental cars, and this is a really good thing to keep in mind because I've run into this problem in the past. Most of the time, depending upon the size of your Pelican case, it is not going to fit well in a standard rental car, one of their compacts or their standard cars. You will generally need to upgrade to at least a full size or an SUV to be able to fit a Pelican case inside the vehicle. I've run into situations before where a standard was a little hybrid and the back seat didn't even fold down. It had a pass-through for skis in the back seat and the Pelican case is not going to fit through the pass-through and there was no way it was fitting sideways in the trunk area. Thankfully, on that trip, we managed to get the doors closed and get the Pelican in kind of diagonal behind the front seats using the footwells and whatever space that we had in the back. And I was able to get the Pelican case in that way, but I've even found larger size cars, if they're hybrid type cars that don't allow the seats to fold down or have some kind of restrictions in the trunk space, you end up with your Pelican case laying across the back seat and you try to get those doors closed and get it in there. And it can be a huge pain in the butt. So I try to stick with full size or SUVs. I never go smaller than a full size if I'm traveling with a Pelican case, because if they don't have the full size car that you want, because a lot of them don't, they just keep the compacts and the SUVs, then you can argue your way into an upgrade to an SUV. So just a little bit of a tip on a rental car, don't try to go cheap on the rental cars. You'll end up in a situation where you're trying to strap a Pelican case to the roof of the car. and that's not the best way to start out your trip. So I hope that helps with some tips and tricks of stuff that I've run into. Our next question comes from Facebook, and Neil asks, advantages/disadvantages of loading a bipod by pressing forward into it versus not loading the bipod. Neil, first of all, I'm going to pick on your language just a little bit. You talk about pressing forward into the bipod. When I hear pressing forward, I'm picturing an active state, something like you get the buttstock in your shoulder pocket and you're rolling your shoulder forward to apply tension to the bipod. That is not what you want to do. You don't want to be in that active muscle state. What I prefer to do when we're loading a bipod is to take the rifle and we're going to pick the buttstock up and we're going to slide our body forward until we get our shoulder in that pocket in kind of an arch shape. And then we're just going to relax and let our body weight drop to the ground. And by levering down and dropping to that ground, you are pushing forward on the rifle and pushing back on your body. And you're not actually pushing. There's no muscles involved. It's just the weight and gravity that is causing that bipod to load forward. Your body is the heavier piece, so when you sink down, your body's going to stay in place and it's going to push that rifle forward and it will load your bipod. Now when you load the bipod, you're taking out any slack in the rifle. I can take the Atlas bipod that we have here, fold the legs down, and you can see that as I move it forward and back, there's just a little bit of slack in here. By pushing forward, when we go down and load the bipod, so by loading the bipod, we are taking out that slack and we are giving a consistent resistance to the rifle for every shot. Obviously, in precision rifle shooting, consistency is key. If you are pushing forward with that shoulder, you're not getting the exact same consistency every time. By just sinking down and letting gravity do the work for you, you're getting more consistent pressure on the buttstock of that rifle for each and every shot, more consistent resistance. So don't think of it as an active state. Think of it as you are putting your body weight against the rifle in a passive state, and you're doing it as consistently as possible. Now, we did a skills video on the prone position, and I'll leave a link to that down below, which goes into a little bit better description and has a little bit of better camera angles to demonstrate to you what I'm talking about. So make sure you check out that skills video, and hopefully as the year goes on, we'll be able to get a few more skills videos in. That one is kind of old, but I think it is a real good demonstration, and really nothing has changed. That video is definitely still relevant. So I hope that answers your question on loading the bipod. And our next question, also from Facebook, comes from Mitch. And Mitch asks, what are the benefits of using a wind meter at your end, as I thought the wind would have more of an impact closer to the target where the bullet is slowing down? Mitch, that's actually an incorrect assumption. While the bullet is slowing down as it goes down range, wind at the muzzle affects the bullet considerably more than wind downrange. If you were able to shoot a bullet in a totally windless environment, if you were able to cancel the wind out completely and you were able to put a fan right next to the muzzle blowing on the bullet and record that deviation and then place the fan blowing on the bullet before it impacts the target and record that deviation, the deviation at the muzzle is going to cause more of a shift downrange than placing the fan right at the target. Now, I'm going to take a minute here and plug John Simpson's book, Sniper Craft. I've been meaning to do a full review of this book, but it has some really, really great basic information, and it actually covers an experiment that he did with a fan, with deviation, or with the fan at the muzzle and with the fan at the target, and measuring the difference in the deviation. So it is a really great read. This book is publicly available through Paladin Press, and we'll put a link down below, and it is a great basic information book for guys that are either prepping to go to sniper school or that want a deeper understanding of the fundamentals of marksmanship. And it covers a very broad range of topics from shooting positions to internal and external ballistics. And it is a really great overall book. It is not that thick. So those of you that are knuckle dragging trigger pullers like me that may not want to sit down and read War and Peace, then this is a fairly short read that has some really, really good information in it, and it is a worthwhile book to pick up and put on your shelf. So again, we'll leave a link down below, and hopefully I will be able to get the full review of this book sometime very soon, because it really is enjoyable. It is a great read and great information. Even if you've been shooting for a good while, books like this are great to pick up just to knock the dust off the fundamentals and get your brain thinking in a correct pattern again. So really good book overall. Hopefully we'll get the review done very soon. And our last question comes from Josh, and Josh asks for Grendel update. And I would assume he's talking about our AR-15 6.5 Grendel project that we've been working on. And the quick and dirty update is the Faxon Firearms 20-inch match series barrel has been shooting absolutely great. We lucked out, and apparently the Hornady 123 grain ELD match black ammunition that we got in, it was posting single digit SDs, so single digit standard deviation, and the ammunition has been working great in this rifle. We took it out in the best group of the day on the last run. Was just phenomenal. I had one shot that I pulled. You guys were being very kind to me and were jumping on there saying it's more than likely the ammunition. I'm pretty sure I shanked the shot, but still overall, the group, even with the shank shot, was fairly nice for this price point of barrel. So right now I'm very, very happy with the Faxon Firearms Match Series barrel, and we're very close to doing our full review on it. It is an attractive barrel. It creates a fairly light overall platform, and really it just performs phenomenally. Now on the end of the barrel, you'll notice we've got this nice break on here. This is actually a Control Solutions break, and this is one of their three-gun breaks. It's one of their smaller breaks. We introduced you guys to their larger break on our 300 Win Mag project, and that tamed down that rifle considerably, and the mass on the barrel, I think, also helped with the harmonics. But on this rifle, this three-gun break, which is a 30 caliber break, although we're running it on a 6.5 rifle, really made this thing a flat shooting, flat recoiling rifle. I can watch the bullet rip through the target on full magnification with this with no problem at all, and it makes it an absolute joy to shoot. Now, this isn't a recoil monster, it's an AR-15, but the goal is when we start to get into unsteady positions, we want to keep that sight picture for as long as we can to be able to spot our impacts when we start shooting steel at longer range, and this break definitely helps out there. We also got a message from Jeremy at Control last night, and in preparation for our full review of the Control breaks, he sent out a discount code. So if you want to pick up a Control Solutions break, you can get 10% off by using the code 8541, and we'll leave a link to Control down below in the description. So we didn't ask him to do that, so it was very nice for Control to kick you guys a little bit of a discount on their breaks. And overall, I'm very impressed with their product. They make a great product. So check them out. And that's about it for this Mail Call Mondays. If you guys have questions or comments for us, you can send them to us at 8541tactical@gmail.com. If you're watching us on YouTube, you can leave it in the comments section down below. And anybody can contact us on Facebook or Twitter. And until next time, get out and shoot.